The following program is a recorded broadcast. Please do not attempt to call the program. Phone lines are not open. It's right there on the cover of Time this week, the new thinking on breast cancer. Talk about the smartest drugs, the gentlest treatments, and the latest in mammograms. This is a big issue. You've seen the commercials where they've said one in every 10 women will be diagnosed with breast cancer in the course of their lifetime. I note in this story in Time magazine that the diagnosed incidence of breast cancer has doubled from 100,000 to 200,000 women in the last two decades. Is that true? What could possibly account for that? We'll talk about that during this hour of Issues, Etc. My guest, Dr. Joel Brind. Our phone number is 1-800-730-2727. That's 1-800-730-2727. We'll talk about the connection between breast cancer and abortion. Dr. Joel Brind is professor of biology and endocrinology at Baruch College of the City University of New York. Dr. Brind, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Good evening. Good to be here.
Is this true, a doubling in the
diagnosed incidence? It's close to double. Yeah, in round figures, that's fairly accurate, yeah.
What do you think accounts for this?
Well, what accounts for the fairly steep rise that went all the way into the mid-1980s was probably changes in family planning, that is to say, women having babies starting later in life. In fact, most of the difference between breast cancer in countries where it's common, more common like here, where it's roughly a 10% chance of getting it, to countries such as everywhere from India to China to Japan, where there's only about a 2% chance of getting it, is the interval between the time a girl becomes a woman, biologically at least, hits puberty, and has her first child. So that really does account for most of the difference. Now, a lot of that has to do with the introduction of birth control pills, which hit the market en masse around 1960. And we saw the effect of that all the way through the 60s and 70s and 80s. And what happened very interesting in the mid-1980s is breast cancer, as with all the other major cancers, the four major cancers being breast, lung, prostate, and colon cancer, they all leveled off or started to go down in the mid-1980s. The one that didn't was breast cancer, actually, although its rate of rise slowed down somewhat. But breast cancer is the only one of the real most common cancers that has kept rising. And if you look at the data that was published in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute, the official annual report that was published last June, it is quite clear that the entire rise is attributable to abortion. It occurs only in women who are under the age of 65 between 1988 and 1998. That is to say, women who were 35 years and younger in 1973, when we had Roe v. Wade. If you look at the older age groups, women over 65, which is actually a much greater proportion of the breast cancer patients, that leveled off in the 1980s. So the only reason breast cancer has been on the rise for the last 10 years, the only single cause that we can clearly attribute it to is abortion. And in fact, we predicted it in our paper in our comprehensive review and meta-analysis on abortion and breast cancer, which we published 5 years ago in the British Medical Association's Epidemiology Journal. So this is all quite predictable, these trends, and we're actually seeing it in the statistics. The real shame of it is that in this official annual report, there is no mention of the dreaded A word, the politically incorrect A word, even though the first author of that study, a Dr. Holly Howe, who's now in Illinois, was in fact the first author of the best study probably that's been done in the world on this, that was published based on the state of New York's medical records from fetal death certificates. And it showed a 90% increase in the risk of breast cancer among women who had chosen abortion. And it's being covered up. It's not being mentioned. And the further research on all these women, which now goes out 10 years further, and is probably the most valuable research, most valuable resource of information on abortions, perhaps in the world, because it goes back to 1970 when abortion was legalized in New York, and because it's all rock-solid medical record-based data, and because it's on millions of women who had abortions in the state of New York. The state of New York Department of Health will not let anyone get their hands on it. They will not follow it up themselves. It is really quite extraordinary and quite a shame that this is being covered up. So the cover-up just continues, and we're trying to punch through it as best we can.
I've noticed that the Time magazine article, if I'm not mistaken, makes no mention of any possible connection between abortion and breast cancer either. I don't know how it goes about explaining the doubling of diagnosed incidents. Can you explain to us in a little more detail the biology, the physiology about this deferring time of childbirth and the connection between abortion and the incidence of breast cancer?
Now,
how does it work?
Well, as a matter of fact, this hints at the fact that there are really two ways that abortion increases the risk of breast cancer. First of all, if a woman is pregnant, or if a girl is pregnant, let's say a 15 or 16-year-old gets pregnant, and she aborts that pregnancy, and then she doesn't have a child, let's say, until she's 35, even without what we call the independent effect of the abortion, just because she has delayed her first childbirth from the age of 15 or 16 to the age of 35, she has tripled her breast cancer risk already. And so abortion does that. It postpones first childbirth. Now, for a woman or for a girl or a young woman who is choosing whether or not to have an abortion or to keep the pregnancy, to keep the baby, have the pregnancy continue to term, she certainly has a right to know that, because compared to the childbirth option, abortion obviously greatly increases her risk of breast cancer because it delays her pregnancy. However, abortion does something else. In addition to delaying first-term pregnancy, it also gives a woman an enormous exposure to the female sex hormone estrogen. Estrogen is actually acknowledged, and I haven't seen that article actually, but I'm sure they mention the word estrogen a lot. If you look at most of the risk factors we know of, they all have to do with some kind of estrogen exposure. So they do acknowledge that women who go into puberty at a younger age, so they have more menstrual cycles and more estrogen exposure, or women who go into menopause at an older age, or women who may be obese in the postmenopausal years because fat tissue actually makes estrogen. All of these things have to do with how much estrogen exposure a woman gets over her lifetime. That's because estrogen's job is to make the breast cells grow. It stimulates some growth every month during the menstrual cycle, but there is nothing, absolutely nothing in a woman's life that exposes a woman to this growth-promoting estrogen like normal pregnancy. In fact, a woman usually feels that she is pregnant because she feels some breast enlargement and tenderness right away. That's from the estrogen, and it starts making the cells in her breast multiply. Now, that's what has to happen because they have to be big enough to supply a baby with milk at the end of the pregnancy. But it's only in about the last 8 weeks that all of that extra breast tissue that's been created becomes what we say differentiated, so that it now is capable of producing milk. And in the breast tissue, as in other tissues in the body, when the cells or the tissues made up of the cells become terminally differentiated to fulfill their final function, their ability to multiply is turned off. So when a woman has a pregnancy that goes all the way to term, what it does is it leaves her with fewer cells in her breast at the end of the pregnancy that are actually non-differentiated and therefore capable of multiplying and capable of possibly being stimulated to become cancer cells later on, perhaps decades later on.
Are those cells in their undifferentiated state, are the undifferentiated cells, are they more susceptible to carcinogens?
Those are the only ones really that are susceptible. It's the undifferentiated ones. Exactly. See, what carcinogens will do, and in fact, there are metabolites of estrogen itself which can cause cancer, which can act as carcinogens. So it doesn't even have to be one of these environmental toxins that they keep looking for and never really finding. It can be estrogen itself when there's a higher exposure to it, or what the body makes out of estrogen. But what a carcinogen does is it mutates the DNA, and then that mistake, that mutation, or that error that is introduced into the DNA becomes propagated as the cell multiplies, and then more mistakes can be made and so on until you get a cell that is so abnormal that it can lead to a cancerous tumor arising. When you have a cell that is terminally differentiated, and it is a cell now that just makes milk, it has its ability to multiply is turned off. So if it gets exposed to a carcinogen, the carcinogen can do as much damage to the DNA as you like. All you're going to get is maybe abnormal milk or an abnormal quantity of milk or maybe no milk at all, but you're not going to get a cancer cell. This has been demonstrated actually in the laboratory. The classical experiment was published over 20 years ago in 1980 in rats, where they took rats that are capable of being given breast cancer by exposing them to a chemical carcinogen. But if they actually are allowed to get pregnant and have a litter of rat pups, they are virtually entirely protected from getting breast cancer. None of them get breast cancer. But if you take the same pups, a controlled experiment now, if you take an experiment, a group of the same rats treated in the same way with the same dose of the same carcinogen and do everything the same except when they get pregnant, you abort that pregnancy, you get almost 80% of them get breast cancer. Almost 80% of them, or virtually none of them, get breast cancer. The only difference in that experimental group is abortion. So it's been shown in controlled experiments in animals, as well as been demonstrated in epidemiological studies, and I mean almost 40 of them going back to 1957.
My guest is Dr. Joel Brend. We're talking about the connection between breast cancer and abortion. The basic story, as I understand it, folks, is that abortion does one thing. It terminates the first pregnancy or any subsequent pregnancies and basically allows the breast to remain for life susceptible to all the carcinogens and even to the possible cancer-producing effects of estrogen itself, not to mention the fact that it exposes a woman in this vulnerable state to a gigantic dose of estrogen that comes with the first pregnancy. Abortion, in a nutshell, is the most preventable risk factor for breast cancer.
Right,
We'll take a break now. When we come back, Dr. Joel Brend is my guest. We'll continue this conversation on breast cancer and abortion.
You're listening to Issues Etc. on the Jubilee Network.
Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. However, we are not funded by the church body. We're also not affiliated with Lutheran Hour Ministries or the Lutheran Layman's League. Issues Etc. is supported by listeners like you. Please help support this worldwide outreach by making a gift this week. Our address, Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Thanks for your prayerful consideration.
Wouldn't it be great if we went through life without any problems? Well, that's just not the way things are. Life can get tough, but we can face whatever comes along with peace and confidence because there is reason for hope. We're your neighbors, the people of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and we'd like you to know that with Christ, there's plenty of hope to go around.
A message from your friends at Issues Etc.
We're talking about the connection between breast cancer and abortion, a connection that you will not find described in the cover story of the most recent Time magazine devoted entirely to breast cancer and its possible cures and preventions. It seems unthinkable to me. My guest is Dr. Joel Brend, professor of biology and endocrinology at Baruch College of the City University of New York. By the way, Dr. Brend's got a website that you can visit where you can do additional research on breast cancer and abortion. I highly recommend that you check it out. It's abortioncancer.com. Abortioncancer, all one word, .com. Dr. Brend, welcome back.
Yes, hi. Thanks, sir, welcoming me back. I wanted to interject that there is a website that's more current than that. That's just abortionbreastcancer.com.
Okay.
That's not actually my website, but I've contributed a lot to it. And we will be having a new website, but that's currently under construction. So the most current information, I would say, abortionbreastcancer, all one word, .com.
Okay. Now, did I get the kind of the layperson's description of the dilemma here towards the end of that last segment?
It was quite perfect. There are two ways that abortion raises the risk of breast cancer. It delays that first term pregnancy for women who haven't had a baby before. And also for any woman who gets an abortion, it exposes her to an enormous amount of growth-stimulating estrogen, which happens in a pregnancy and whose effect is normally neutralized in the last 8 weeks. But, of course, if the pregnancy is aborted, that doesn't happen. So she's left with more of these cells, which are not differentiated to produce milk, capable of multiplying, capable of being transformed by carcinogens into potential cancer cells. And this is observed as an increased incidence of breast cancer in women who've had abortions. And that's been shown right now in a total of 28 out of 37 studies worldwide since 1957. In this country, 13 out of 15 studies have shown it.
Why in the world, you mentioned before the New York not allowing this information to get out. Why in the world, if it could reduce the incidence of breast cancer in women, which it seems to be what people want to do, why is this information being withheld?
Two words, safe abortion. That's what they're protecting. They're protecting the idea of safe abortion.
So this really isn't about women's health anymore, is it?
Oh, it is not at all. It's about the abortion mentality. It is about the, it is about this whole culture of death, actually. I mean, and the idea that abortion is safe for women must be protected. You can actually, for example, there was an article recently written in a very prestigious medical journal called The Lancet Oncology in England. And it was a letter that actually was mostly about my research. It was a column that a surgeon wrote, and he's trying to say how we shouldn't really tell women that there's a connection between abortion and breast cancer. And right there in the title, you know what the title of the article was? It was, Abortion and Breast Cancer, A Hard Decision Made Harder. Well, obviously the man is pro-abortion, because if you're leaning toward not having the abortion, it makes a hard decision easier, doesn't it? So this hard decision is made harder because obviously, he favors the decision to have an abortion. So the pro-abortion mentality is very clear in a lot of the things that you see written. There are a lot of people out there who consider themselves quite sincerely to be pro-choice, who are not fans of abortion and don't necessarily advocate abortion, but they think a woman should have a right to choose it because it's happening all within her own body. And these kinds of people, I obviously disagree with them, but I work with them all the time, and that's not a problem. The problem is the people who are at the head of, for example, cancer societies and public health organizations, and who claim to be pro-choice. They're not pro-choice. There's only one choice they're interested in, and that choice is abortion. And it is this effort to protect safe abortion. I mean, they even write editorials about the need to defend abortion from attacks on it, such as mounted by evil people as myself. You know, I mean, it really is amazing. But that's what it's all about, I'm convinced, because I've been now trying to get the word out on this and researching it and publicizing it. This is my 10th year of doing it. And so it's become quite clear exactly what's going on.
Let's go to the phones. Our phone number is 1-800-730-2727. Tim is on the line. Tim, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, Pastor Wilkin. I've got a question about the birth control pill. Your guest said in 1960, when abortion or birth control pills became prevalent, there was a rise in breast cancer resulting from that. And I know a lot of birth control pills have estrogen, and I guess an increased exposure to that is a risk for breast cancer. So is... are birth control pills also a cause for breast cancer, and how does it compare to abortion?
Good question.
Yeah, it is a good question, and I can this a couple of different facets to the answer. First of all, in the context in which I mentioned birth control pills as a means of postponing first childbirth, it doesn't really matter how it's postponed. If it's postponed, that increases the risk of breast cancer, whether it be the pill, the abortion, or even abstinence. However, it is true that birth control pills have estrogen in them, generally, and the estrogen they have in them is a very potent synthetic estrogen. It's more potent than the estrogen that a woman's ovaries produce. It does increase the risk of breast cancer, certainly when it is taken for extended periods of time by women before they have a child, in particular the ones who are the main target audience, the teenage girls. Because, you see, it's quite normal for teenage girls to have not quite full adult levels of estrogen for up to several years. So their periods tend to be irregular. They may have cramping. They may have anovulatory cycles where they bleed a lot and they don't ovulate. They may be on and off. And what happens is something very, very rather insidious. What happens is girls, they may have cramping, irregularity, acne, all of that sort of thing. And so the doctor says, oh, we can fix that. And he puts her on the pill. And it does fix that. Her cycles become instantly regular because they are entrained by regular pill use. It does help to clear up acne. And also, it increases their breast size, which they like and the boys like and all that. And, of course, the fact that it increases their breast size is proof right on its face that it increases the risk of breast cancer because it has increased the amount of tissue they have in their breasts, which has become vulnerable to carcinogens.
Now, that is the teenage girl.
Right.
What about a woman who uses the pill after a normal-term first pregnancy?
I think the if there is an increased risk, it is probably very slight. So in other words, women who've had a couple of kids and then they start taking the pill and they take the pill even for a number of years, the amount of estrogen that they get from the pills is probably very close to the amount of estrogen that they would get produced by their ovaries. And you see if a very, very slight increase, if any, and it seems to go away with time after the use of the pill is ceased. So it really does seem to be the younger women before they've had a first-term pregnancy. And the real difference between the pill, whether it's the birth control pill or the postmenopausal estrogen replacement pill, which also increases the risk of breast cancer with long-term use, is that we're talking about the effect of taking hundreds or even thousands of pills over an extended period of time. With abortion, we're talking about just one wrong choice.
So it is proportionally, abortion is proportionally the far greater factor.
Oh, sure, because one abortion makes a difference. I mean, a lot of times we'll make the comparison with cigarettes, especially because of the cover-up that's going on about it, which was going on with cigarettes for so many years, all the denial. And many people who speak against my research will say, well, you know, the connection with cigarettes is much, much stronger because you're 10 times likely to get lung cancer if you smoke a pack a day for a year. Well, a pack a day for a year is 73,000 cigarettes, and we're certainly not talking about 73,000 abortions or even two abortions. Just one abortion makes a measurable difference in a woman's risk of getting breast cancer, and for some women, it's an enormous difference, especially if they're really young, teenagers, and haven't had a child before, and especially if they are teenagers who have a family history of breast cancer. In the one study that's thus far been published.
Let's take a break right here. I want to hear
okay.
about that study when we come back from our break. Dr. Joel Brind is my guest, professor of biology and endocrinology at Baruch College of the City University of New York. We'll also take some phone calls when we get back as well. 1-800-730-2727 is our phone number. 1-800-730-2727.
You're listening to Issues Etc. on the Jubilee Network.
There are things for which an uncompromising stand is worthwhile. These words were written in 1935 in Nazi Germany. The man who wrote them was Pastor Dietrich Bonhoeffer. While many Christians remained silent during the rise and reign of National Socialism in Germany, why did Bonhoeffer speak out? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July is Till the Night Be Past, The Life and Times of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. You can order Till the Night Be Past online at issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on this book. Or call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours at 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or issuesetc.org. Find out why the life of Dietrich Bonhoeffer still impacts Christians today.
Now this Global Minute focuses prayer on your children. Pray that their careers will include sharing Christ across cultures. Even if your children don't become career missionaries, you can help them learn what it means to share Christ with people who don't know Him. Get some ideas by logging onto the website worldwidekidsclub.com. It's a website operated by the mission agency EBM International. Worldwide Kids uses music and creative ideas to get kids like yours focused on making Christ known among unreached people. Cross-cultural ministry can happen in the neighborhoods where you live, especially if you live near a college or university. Pray for your children and the career that God has in store for them. Ask the Lord to make your children open to cross-cultural ministry. Get missions info and ideas by logging on to the website worldwidekidsclub.com. That's worldwidekidsclub.com.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Visit the concentration camp Buchenwald, and you'll see a room where prisoners were brought for a, quote, medical exam. The exam included standing against a wall to measure your height. You'll see what the prisoner did not, a small slit in that wall through which a guard on the other side would shoot and kill him. Qusay Hussein. Among his atrocities, he'd sometimes have his victims killed by dropping them into a shredding machine. If the victim was dropped in head first, death was quick. Feet first, slow and painful beyond words. Not everything that happened in the Bible is commanded to us, including all the specifics of ancient Israel's government. The Bible is, among other things, a book of history. Still, it is God's book and contains His commands about contemporary government. One is the duty of the state to punish evil and promote good. 1 Peter 2:14. Evil didn't die with Qusay and Odai. Former Representative Tim Raymer hopes that a terrorism report issued today will, quote, rivet the American people's attention on the continuing problem of terrorism. Amen to that.
We seldom leap into our addictions.
On the next Focus on the Family, recognizing and dealing with codependency.
Any activity that becomes central has the potential for becoming an addiction.
How do addictions affect women differently than men? Janet Farshall and Sharon Hirsch tackle this question and more on the next Focus on the Family.
Weekdays at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
The following program is a recorded broadcast. Please do not attempt to call the program. Phone lines are not open. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. My guest during this hour, Dr. Joel Brind, professor of biology and endocrinology at Baruch College of the City University of New York. And we're talking about the connection between breast cancer and abortion. Real quickly, Dr. Brind, you mentioned before the break that there was one study you were aware of on family history and breast cancer. Tell us about that.
Well, yeah, so there are a number of studies, but the most dramatic was actually the one study that was funded by the National Cancer Institute for the specific reason of looking at the link between abortion and breast cancer. That was done by Dr. Janet Dehling and colleagues at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Institute in Seattle, Washington, in 1994. And it made some news because they reported that, yes, indeed, there was an overall increase in risk that women who had chosen abortion were 50% more likely to get breast cancer by the age of 45. And this was covered in the press with an awful lot of spin. And in fact, more than spin, some of the most ominous findings in the study never saw the light of day outside of the medical journal in which they appear. And that is that women who had had an abortion before the age of 18 or over the age of 30 had a risk that was more than doubled. For women, in fact, who had an abortion before the age of 18 and who also had any positive family history of breast cancer, the reported number was relative risk equals infinity. There were 12 women in that whole study out of 1,800 who had an abortion as a teenager, who had a family history of breast cancer. And although half the women in the study had breast cancer and half the women were control women who did not have breast cancer, all of the women who had that reproductive history and that family history ended up getting breast cancer by the age of 45.
So that's a third strike. If you are a young woman who defers first pregnancy via abortion.
Right.
And if you you have the two strikes against you that abortion brings as a risk of breast cancer, the third strike would be if you're that same young woman who has a history of breast cancer already.
Well, no, who has a family history.
A family history.
And sometimes that doesn't happen till afterwards. Right now, in fact, I'm an expert witness in a case where a woman is suing the abortion practitioner for not warning her about the abortion breast cancer connection. She got that abortion when she was 17. Now she's a woman. She's reached the age of majority at 19. She's suing the abortionist, and in the process, in the years now since she had the abortion, 2 years later, her grandmother has just been diagnosed with breast cancer. So the family history did not even exist at the time. So this is something where you can't even tell. You have a 13, 14, 15 year old a girl who's looking for an abortion, especially if she's doing it without parental knowledge or consent. It may be that her grandmother died even before she was born of breast cancer and she doesn't know about it, or it may very well be that her breast cancer is a woman who is still in her 40s or 50s and is diagnosed with breast cancer some years later. That still counts.
Our phone number is 1-800-730-2727. Let's talk with Jill. She's been waiting on her car phone. Hi, Jill.
Hi. I was wondering, I came in kind of late on this conversation, but what if the first pregnancy ended in miscarriage in your 20s? What would be the risk of developing breast cancer later on?
Jill, that's okay. A very good question. Thanks.
First of all, is that a hands-free car phone? We're in New York State, after all, right?
No, she's calling from someplace else.
Oh, okay. Most miscarriages, in fact, don't increase the risk of breast cancer. Usually they're first trimester ones. And, in fact, women often notice with these miscarriages that if they do have a normal pregnancy, that the miscarriage didn't seem to have the same effect on them, didn't give them the same breast tenderness or morning sickness or any of that. And that's usually because spontaneous abortions, or we also call them miscarriages, don't have that kind of estrogen surge that normal pregnancies do. See, in order to keep the pregnancy going, it has to have a certain amount, a very large amount of the hormone progesterone. And if the progesterone, for one reason or another, is inadequate, the pregnancy will fail. Now, estrogen, although not necessary to maintain the pregnancy, is made from progesterone. So if there's a shortage of progesterone, there's also a shortage of estrogen. And this is borne out in decades worth of epidemiological studies also, that spontaneous abortions generally do not increase the risk of breast cancer. I say generally because there are those, for example, that may be later miscarriages that may be due to cervical incompetence or disease or trauma of some kind. And those would be more accurately classified as inadvertently induced abortions. The main thing is whether a normal pregnancy is interrupted sometime before about 32 weeks. And by the way, it doesn't even matter that it's an abortion. If a woman has a very early premature birth, even if the baby's fine, before 32 weeks, that also increases the risk of breast cancer, which means that women like that should definitely be advised to go through the difficult experience of getting the baby on the breast so that her breast can become differentiated and she can have a protective effect against breast cancer rather than an increased risk of breast cancer. But of course, with an abortion, you can't breastfeed a dead baby, as one of my colleagues is fond of saying. So
now,
a live baby has its advantages at any stage.
Does it matter whether or not the abortion is a surgical abortion or whether or not a woman is using, say, RU486?
Well, in fact, while I was waiting, I was just answering an email with a woman who had exactly that question. In fact, there's nothing about RU486 or, for that matter, methotrexate or any other drug that induces an abortion that would change what's happened hormonally to the cells in the breast. So although there's no specific epidemiologic data on it, there's no reason to expect that it would be any different than a surgical abortion done at the same stage of pregnancy.
One might say that RU486 might be employed much earlier in the pregnancy. Would that be a factor?
Well, it would be a factor when it's the pregnancy. In other words, a surgical abortion or a chemical abortion at 6 weeks would presumably be less harmful than a 10-week abortion, something like that. The longer that the pregnancy goes, the more exposure there is to estrogen, and there is some good data that does show that with longer gestational ages at the time of abortion, there is a greater risk.
But the fact of the matter is, many women don't realize they're pregnant until they're well into that 16 or those longer weeks of the pregnancy, right?
Well, her body knows. She may not know it, but
right.
the cells are still chugging right along, and they're multiplying, and the estrogen effects are showing up in her breast, and she's getting more and more cells built up in her breast as the pregnancy goes on, which can ultimately produce cancer. But if the pregnancy, of course, goes to completion, those cells will be converted to milk-producing cells. Even if she doesn't use them as such, at least they have become differentiated to produce milk, and they're no longer susceptible to carcinogen.
Somebody might say, why not then just opt for what I would consider to be the most gruesome of options, but those kind of things don't bother pro-choicers. Why not just opt for a late-term abortion as late as possible?
You mean after 32 weeks?
Well, yeah, I'm thinking about if we can...
Yeah, in other words, if we could say, gee, if we wait 30, let's give you an abortion at 32 or 33 weeks.
Yeah.
I mean, even under Roe v. Wade, a lot of states do have post-viability bans. I mean, there's absolutely... I mean, if you're going to go for that, I mean, what on earth is the justification for killing a viable child? I mean, everybody yeah. knows that you can if you want. If a woman just says, listen, I've got to terminate this pregnancy, you can terminate the pregnancy just fine at 32 weeks without killing anybody. that's why not, because it hardly needs any justification to say why not, because you don't kill anybody that way. And you can give the woman her right to terminate the pregnancy at that time.
And in other words, you're inducing labor and the child goes up for adoption.
That's it. You can, if she says, I've got to terminate this pregnancy as soon as possible, but I don't want my risk of breast cancer to go up, so wait till I'm 32 or 33 weeks. Doctor says, okay, we'll do that. We'll induce it 32 or 33 weeks, but don't ask me to kill the baby. We just easily give him away.
Now, but I can just see the pro-life community finally giving in on the link between breast cancer and abortion and saying this is all the more reason we need partial birth abortion to be legal and safe and all the terms that they attach to it.
Well, if the public goes for that, then our culture has gone further downhill than any of us had suspected. But I think that the public opinion polls that have been taken quite consistently and even more dramatically in the last couple of years as the partial birth abortion debate has been raging in state houses and in the nation's capital. The public is really quite solidly, I think by at least a 2-to-1 majority, against allowing that to take place. In fact, something like the public is divided pretty much down the middle as to whether abortion should be legal or not at all, except in very extreme circumstances. And there's a large portion of the population, perhaps a majority, doesn't even realize that abortion beyond the first trimester is generally legal. If you ask most people what's legal under Roe v. Wade, they'll say, well, a woman has the right to have an abortion up through the first trimester. And they don't even know that it's legal under, virtually on demand at any time thereafter. So it's a matter of the public not knowing what the law is, and once an issue is debated enough in the public square so that the public realizes, yes, indeed, there is partial birth abortion going on, yes, indeed, there are a lot of late-term abortions, polls show quite consistently that the public is overwhelmingly against that. So I think we have enough reserve of real ethics and real civilization in our country to survive that kind of a movement. I sure hope so.
My guest is Dr. Joel Brind. We'll take another break, and when we come back, we'll round off our conversation with about another 10 minutes talking about the connection between breast cancer and abortion. The questions I have when we come back, what is the answer to this? Dr. Brind mentioned that he's involved in a lawsuit, women suing abortion providers for failing to tell them about the breast cancer risk, especially if they discover later that they have a family history of breast cancer, which is the third strike in this compounding of risk for a woman in connection between abortion and breast cancer. What about legislation that would require abortion providers to fully notify those who are considering abortion about the breast cancer risk? If we can't get the research agencies and the various institutes of health and medical journals to fess up on the real connection between abortion and breast cancer, is there any chance that we can get legislation that would require abortion providers to talk about it with people who want abortions? If you'd like to do additional research on breast cancer and abortion, I highly recommend that you check out Dr. Joel Brind's website. It's abortionbreastcancer.com. All one word, abortionbreastcancer.com. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Issues Etc. on the Jubilee Network.
Early in the morning, the pastor knelt to pray one last time. A judge, handpicked by Adolf Hitler, had condemned this pastor to death. In a few moments, he would hang dead from a Nazi gallows. It was April 9, 1945. Dietrich Bonhoeffer was 39 years old. Why has the life story of Dietrich Bonhoeffer made such an impact on Christians? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July is Till the Night Be Past, The Life and Times of Dietrich Bonhoeffer by the late Theodore Kleinhaus. You can order Till the Night Be Past online at issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on this book. Or call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours at 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or issuesetc.org. Folks, if you enjoy these discussions on social, moral, cultural issues like the one we're having in this hour with Dr. Joel Brind that we provide to you on a regular basis here at Issues Etc., you need to get the latest edition of the Issues Etc. Journal. The latest issue contains tape and book resources on medical ethics in America, stem cell research, the practical ethics of Peter Singer of all people, and much more. So call 1-800-737-0172 and ask to receive a complimentary copy of our Issues Etc. Journal. The number is 1-800-737-0172. I've also written two articles in this journal, one titled The Gospel in the Background, another dealing with the September 11th tragedy titled Is God Trying to Tell Us Something? Plus, Dr. Ken Cherb, a regular guest on the show, has written an article on Martin Luther and anti-Semitism. So call now, 1-800-737-0172, that's 1-800-737-0172, and ask to receive a complimentary copy of the Issues Etc. Journal. Right now I'm looking at the website of Dr. Joel Brind, one that he has contributed quite a bit to. It's abortionbreastcancer.com, and if you go there, especially if you have questions that you don't have time to raise during our conversation, many of the questions can be answered right there, plus there's a wealth of resources. Even one that says, what if I have had an abortion? That's got to be the biggest question that a woman who's had an abortion in discovering this connection might find. What's the answer here, Dr. Brind? Is it the kind of the lawsuit that you say you're involved with where women could sue abortion providers for failing to properly inform them?
I think so. I think when you look at just how things work in the United States, you talk about the legal status of abortion. The name is Roe v. Wade. Well, what's Roe v. Wade? It's not the name of a law. It's the name of a lawsuit. And the reason, I think, is because that is where you can force the debate. I mean, I would love to debate this issue with anybody who wants to debate me and have always asked for it. And even on the rare occasions when I've gotten some coverage on a mainstream television show, for example, they have a lot of trouble finding people who would be willing to debate me. In the courts, you can force the debate. You know, once you actually get into court and the lawsuit is accepted and it's there, then people have to they have to speak the truth. They get cross-examined, and you can actually force the debate to take place. For example, in the state of Florida, in 1998, they passed the parental notification law, and promptly the abortion providers took them to court and made a facial challenge to the law, said it was contrary to the Florida Constitution, deprived young women of their rights and all of that, you know, that it was somehow wrong even to notify the parents, let alone ask their permission about an abortion. Well, the abortion breast cancer risk came into the debate. I was invited to participate in the suit on behalf of Florida defending its state law for Governor Jeb Bush. What made that relevant was, as we've discussed before in this program, the much enhanced risk increase that occurs for women who, or for girls who have an abortion, teenagers, and that's what this law is all about, and how it would more than double their risk of breast cancer and a lot more if they had family history. Well, we got their expert on the stand, who is a well-known epidemiologist and pro-abortion and willing to toe the party line and all of that. But then when we asked her, when our attorney asked her the simple question, so if a girl, if a 15-year-old is pregnant, is she going to have a greater risk of breast cancer later in life if she has the abortion or if she has the child? And she gave the answer, well, probably if she has the abortion. Well, let's say we have two girls who are 15 years old and they're both pregnant, and all other things being equal, one chooses to have the abortion, one chooses to have the baby. Which one is likely to get more likely to get breast cancer later in life? And she gave the answer, probably the one who had an abortion. There you go, their witness. You know, when you actually corner them and you don't let them wiggle out of it by spinning the words so that the answer is virtually unrecognizable, they have to admit that, yes, indeed, when you compare abortion to childbirth, and that's the only comparison that can be made, honestly, because that is the nature of the choice, abortion is going to leave a woman with a greater risk of breast cancer. So that's the... by the way, that we lost in the district court because the judge saw fit to ignore the evidence. We won, however, in a unanimous appeal, and the Florida Supreme Court has agreed on a 4-3 vote to take the case. And so sometime in the coming months, there should be a final ruling on the law in Florida. Now, that's not about abortion breast cancer per se, but that did figure into the evidence presented at court. Other court cases which are now ongoing include one in North Dakota and one in California, which are not even personal injury cases. They are cases merely brought by women on behalf of the general public to get the abortion providers to stop lying to their clients and potential clients about the abortion breast cancer link. And so in the next couple of months, we should know what's going on there. There'll be some trial hearings coming up even in a matter of weeks in these cases. So there should be some news about what kind of reception these get in the courts.
Do you foresee any legislation that might require abortion providers to at least provide the information? They can say, well, this is or may not be true, but they at least have to provide the information?
There are some states with such laws. In fact, there are three states, Mississippi, Montana. I'm sorry, not Montana was it's tied up in court. Mississippi, Louisiana, and Kansas all by law require that every woman looking for an abortion be given a state-printed booklet that shows that there is evidence, at least, that there's that there is a risk, an increased risk with abortion, although it's not very strong language. It says, well, some studies say there is, some studies say there isn't. There is another state, Texas, which has a parental notification law, which was one of the things that then-Governor Bush pushed through in his second term before he became president of the United States. He got some language, actually, on abortion breast cancer in the booklet that is handed to girls who are looking for the courts to grant them the right to have an abortion without their parents' knowledge. And in that booklet, it does say that several studies show an increased risk of breast cancer in women who choose abortion. So the president himself actually has a record on this. We're hopeful, of course, that in time, as his actual philosophy begins to work its way down through the federal bureaucracies, that this will show up in perhaps federal legislation. It's very difficult now because, of course, without the control of the Senate, President Bush cannot appoint whom he would like to be, let's say, chairman of the FDA or chairman of the National Institutes of Health. I mean, he can to some extent, but he has to worry about whether or not those choices get confirmed. This confirmation process is not just about Supreme Court and other justices. It's about the directorships of some of the most important federal agencies in the Department of Health and Human Services. So it's a tough road ahead. It's more than just winning the presidential election. It has to do with the makeup of the Senate. So the next election is probably as important as any other for all the issues concerning abortion or any of the other life issues, to see whether or not the Senate remains in the hands of the likes of Tom Daschle and Ted Kennedy, or is actually opened up and put into the hands of people who are not such partisans. I mean, they're all partisans, of course, but there are those who are really, such as Daschle and Kennedy, who really have a very strong history of towing the pro-abortion party line, and they are certainly abortion partisans. And so it's important to have our federal and state legislatures not being controlled by pro-abortionists, simple as that. So it's a numbers game. In terms of what the president himself will be able to do as far as getting the word out. But we're hopeful that things will improve over the course of his tenure as president, which we hope will be a long one.
Dr. Joel Brin, thank you very much for being our guest.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to talk about this. It's been my pleasure.
Dr. Joel Brin is professor of biology and endocrinology at Baruch College of the City University of New York. He's got a website to which he has contributed in a major way. We can read many of the resources he's provided is abortionbreastcancer.com. It's abortionbreastcancer.com. If you'd like to purchase a cassette copy of this program for a contribution of $6.50, or if you want to receive a complimentary copy of our Issues Etc. journal, or if you'd like to make a credit card donation to Issues Etc., just call our resource line. It's 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. If we can just get the facts out, the facts that that numerous studies indicate that there is a connection, a deadly connection, between abortion and breast cancer. Abortion is bad enough in and of itself because it always leaves one dead and, as many are wont to say, another wounded. But a woman who's had an abortion, especially those young women, having it without their parents' consent, without enough knowledge of their own lives or their bodies to make an informed decision, who are urged to take this track and have an abortion, and then later to find out that they have substantially increased their risk of breast cancer. It makes abortion that much more dangerous. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.